At the end of the last lecture, we talked a little bit about Dante as a learned poet, somebody who meditated on and appropriated to himself a number of very, very important texts that really were part of earlier traditions. What we want to do in a somewhat more systematic way today is talk about the way, in fact, that Dante was able to use those texts in the Commedia itself, the way in which he was able to build on what previously existed so that he would be able to deal with issues at a pretty sophisticated level, taking what was already there as a kind of starting point. So what we're going to do is suggest that these other texts really become for him a source of energy and also help to account for some of the organizational principles of his own poem. And so to do that, we're going to start with the blockbuster of all texts, the text that was most fundamental to the way Dante thought and wrote. And that text, of course, would be the Christian Bible.
First of all, it is hard, I think, even today for Christians to understand how central the Bible was to people in the Middle Ages, because it was not just the source of their religious ideas, of their organization of their churches and whatever, but it was a mine in which one could find valuable stuff about every conceivable subject. Obviously, things related to purely religious and theological things, such as ethics, but also politics, raising your child, or whatever it might be. The Bible was seen as a source of a different kind than all other sources. It didn't block out the value of non-biblical, non-Judeo-Christian texts, but everything was in some ways seen through the prism of the Bible's standards. And therefore, we need to start with this extraordinary thing. Of course, one of the difficulties in talking about the Bible is it isn't a book. That is to say, it's a collection, an anthology of Hebrew literature and the earliest Christian literature. And today, a lot of modern scholarship emphasizes the different origins of books or parts of books and recreates the historical context in which Isaiah wrote or the evangelist John wrote or whatever it might be. And that's all well and good. Dante would not have known a lot of that stuff or probably cared very much about that sort of stuff that we call a lot of biblical scholarship today. Rather, the Bible was a book of life. It was a story. It was a story that had a beginning and a story that had an end. It had huge narrative pieces, but also beautiful poetry. It was a literary model as well as a book of information and a guide. And I think we need to have that comprehensive understanding of the Bible before we can see what it is that Dante is going to do with those texts.
I want to add to what Bill said in terms of the importance of the Bible, again, by suggesting some differences between the way it's looked on now and the way it was looked at back then. It's important to see this not simply as a book or even a collection of books, although it was that, but that those books themselves were seen to be a record of acts, that is to say, the action of God working in history. As Bill suggested, it had a plot. Okay, and that plot, to be a little bit more specific, goes from creation all the way to last judgment. And so somebody looking at that book would see all of human history contained in it and therefore see oneself implicated in that story. In other words, you look at the Bible and you say, yeah, that tells us about how God acted in history, but it's also telling us about how he acts in history. And as such, part of what we have to do is learn how to read it appropriately so that we can learn how to see the meaning in history, the meaning of our own life, the meaning of our own actions. Okay? So it's important, again, to kind of try and develop this medieval mindset when we think about the way in which Dante mined the Bible.
In other words, I think what Ron's suggesting, if I can sort of build on his thoughts, is that today, it's easy to look at the Bible as a historical record of a people who lived a long time ago, that the last dot was put on the last sentence of the Bible, you know, 1900 plus years ago, perhaps. And therefore, it seems very different from the world we inhabit. It seems like a strange place, if you will, this biblical world, just as ancient history seems like a strange place. And obviously today, one of the things that sermons do, for example, is try to bridge that gap. In many ways, in the Middle Ages, it was a much more systematic enterprise. First of all, they didn't believe there was nearly as big a gap to bridge. But secondly, there was this constant dialogue, conscious dialogue, between the past and the present. Not what did the Bible mean for those folks, what does it mean for me? Not just in terms of general ideas or an occasional favorite story to draw a moral from, but as Dante later on himself, line by line by line, what did this mean then? What does this mean now? What will this mean for our future, which also, again, is going somewhere toward an end that is described prophetically at the end of the Bible in the book of Revelation?
Another way that they looked at the Bible, they were pretty clear about the fact that God wrote it. They were not literalists or fundamentalists, or perhaps would be a better term, as we sometimes suspect they were. But the fact is, they were convinced that these scriptures were sacred, they were authored by God, and that this showed God's workings in history in the same way that God's other book did, which was the universe itself. In other words, that sense of creation, since we are created and since there is a creator, one of the very best images they had to sort of think about that process was that creation was like a book authored by God. And that sort of set the relationship right for them. Well, if creation was, if you will, God's first book, the Bible turned out to be not only his second and parallel book, but as many thinkers in the Middle Ages put it, it was the interpretive key to his first book. In other words, one reads the Bible in order to discover things about the first book authored by God, about the universe itself. So again, this sense of the Bible as a source, we need to start with all of these things that give it a place that, as Bill put it at the very beginning of this lecture, very difficult for us to relate to because of modern ways that we have of looking at this text.
Let me illustrate this with beginning with a story everybody's familiar with, the story of creation in Genesis. I think this is a way that medieval people would look at that story. First of all, it says that humans are created in the image of God. Therefore, the more you know about God, the more you know about humans. After all, it doesn't make any sense to say I can understand the image of God without understanding what it is that's being imaged. A second thing is that in that same creation story in Genesis, God gives certain commands to humans, and he gives them certain things that other people don't have, or other creatures don't have. So people can talk, for example, while other creatures can't. So God endows them with certain gifts and then says, go out and use those gifts in imitation of me. Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over, and so on and so forth. And so, if you will, what humans are and what humans image is all laid out at the beginning. And every word of the Bible, quite literally, was seen, therefore, to be a guide to knowing God and therefore also a guide to human conduct.
Okay, so we've established the importance of the text. What we need to talk about next is how they went about reading it. Given its importance, they spent a lot of time saying, well, there are good ways to read it and not so good. What are the best ways? They were very concerned about the fact that the Bible, you open it, it's divided into two parts, the Old Testament, which is the story of a people chosen by God, as the story goes, the Hebrews, right? And that story is given right from the time of Abraham all the way through the ups and downs of their history. But if you want the continuation of that story in the New Testament, then it kind of changes focus a little bit and talks about the impact of one particular Hebrew, Jesus Christ. And so you have this stark division, really, between Old and New Testament. One of the issues that they had to deal with in a very explicit way is, what is the relationship between these two different bodies of literature written at different times, written in different languages? Old Testament originally written in Hebrew, New Testament originally written in Greek, and in fact seeming to deal with different things. Is there a way to make sure that we see some kind of continuity, some kind of connection between these two parts of the Bible?
Another way to put it is something like this, that you've got the Old Testament with all of these stories and laws and rules of regulation, rules and regulations. Clearly, it is sacred scripture for Christians, and clearly, Christians are to be guided by it. On the other hand, there are many specific parts of the Old Testament that Christians regard as not binding. For example, Christians don't practice the dietary regulations of Jews, nor are they circumcised, at least by religious ritual. And so, how do you deal with this body of literature that A, is sacred, is the writing of God, and B, is problematic given the way Christians live and even given some of the things that New Testament writers say?
Well, one of the ways they looked at it is by saying, what's the most central thing that happens in this story that begins with creation and that ends with the last judgment at the end of time? To Christians, it was God entering the world in the form of Jesus Christ, God's Son. Well, what they did was say, well, how are we going to take that and look at the previous history of the Hebrews, and how are we going to see that previous history in relation to this event? What they did was say, there is a relationship, and the relationship is as follows. Those events that took place in the Old Testament, they are, for the most part, historically true. They are important to know and understand in and of themselves, but they are not complete in themselves because we don't really know what the story means, what the full story means, until we see how they are related to those events that connect with the life of Christ in the new. In other words, what they did was develop, in a fairly systematic way, a relationship between people and events in the old and the person and the events in the life of Christ in the new. And systematically studying and exploring that relationship turns out to be a large part of what occupied the mind of biblical, what we would call biblical scholars, of people who wrote and commented about the Bible in the Middle Ages.
That word systematic that Ron used is really clear, because in the New Testament itself, there are suggestions of this. Paul talks about all the prophets really talking about Jesus. John talks about that the real bread of life is not the manna in the desert, but is Jesus coming down from heaven. What happens in the centuries just before and Dante's own century is the attempt to make this systematic, line by line, correspondence by correspondence. You'll see, for example, paintings or stained glass windows in which you'll have a whole strip of Old Testament stories, and then right next to them, usually with some sort of visual connection, you will see their New Testament analogs or New Testament fulfillments, so that it does become a kind of system. And Dante, we don't know quite how his education all unfolded, really was deeply initiated into not just the idea of doing this, but the system and the thoroughness of doing it line by line, story by story.
So, again, to use a couple of specific examples from biblical exegesis, that will set us up to sort of moving to see the way Dante does it. What they did was take a look at a very important figure, let's say, in Hebrew scripture, like King David, say that, well, if you look at David in the various roles that he plays as king, as shepherd, as somebody who is very important in the development of the Hebrew sense of their own identity, those same attributes were given to Jesus, who was seen to be a king in the line of David. And so if you look at what you have with the story of David from this perspective, you say that everything that you see about him in Hebrew scripture is real and important, but it's not the whole story. You have to know how the story comes out before you can see the way that works.
One illustration that is often given to sort of begin our discussion of this is to say, well, we've got the story of Jonah and the whale, a famous story from the book of the prophet Jonah. and the whale or the fish swallowed Jonah, and 3 days later he spit up on the shore. Well, there's a clue even in the New Testament that says this is linked to Jesus. Just as Jonah was in the belly of the whale and came out, so was Jesus in the belly of the earth in the grave, and then he came out on the third day as well. And so that's the kind of way that we find these very specific connections all the way through. You'll find pictures in the Middle Ages, again in stained glass windows, of the resurrection over here, and here's Jonah climbing out of a big fish right over here. We need to understand one in terms of the other. The Jonah story is not complete without the Jesus story, and the Jesus story is better understood if you have the Jonah antecedent.
Well, what we're going to do now is make the outrageous case that Dante writes his own poem in imitation of the Bible. Not simply that he uses stories from the Bible, which he does, not simply that he uses characters from the Bible, which he does. The pilgrim is going to meet a bunch of them and chat with them even in some cases. Not simply that he gives the Bible this special place, but he's writing in imitation of the Bible in the fundamental sense that just as the Bible proceeds according to this typological way in which an event is related to other events and can't really be understood except in terms of those other events, so also with his poem, that one way to state it is that you can't really understand anything that happens in the beginning of the poem, let's say in the first part, in the Inferno, without fully understanding what comes next in the Purgatorio and in the Paradiso, that there are events and characters in the latter parts of the poem which refer back to and complete things that happened earlier on.
Dante has a number of ways of helping us to do that. The mistake a lot of readers make, I think, especially those who only read the Inferno, is assuming that if they've read the Inferno, they've really got down Dante's point of view, his understanding of everything. They know what he thinks about this political issue or this moral issue or whatever. And of course, what they miss is exactly what Ron's describing. Because just as in Scripture, the same issues, if you will, come up again and again and again and again, and we get a number of different ways to look at them, either within the Old Testament or within the New Testament or between the two Testaments, so similarly do we really need to get to the end. In fact, one of the great lines of Dante scholarship is, when you finish reading the poem, you're ready to read the poem.
And another one of the lines is that Dante expects us to take this poem as though it had the same kind of historical reality that Scripture does. Think about that for a minute. As we said earlier, one of the things that made Scripture so important was that for the Christian, it was the record of God's actions in history. Okay, that it was not a text self-contained, but it was a text that spoke to and about actions that really happened. Now, most of us don't believe that Dante really did take this trip to the afterlife. All right, there are some exceptions to that. I was reading an essay by somebody the other day who said she was, in fact, taught by somebody who believed fully that Dante really did take that trip. I guess you're allowed to do that, and at some of our more extravagant moments, we're very sympathetic to that perspective. But for the most part, we think that this is a fiction that Dante invented about the journey of a character named Dante to the afterlife. But in one of the great one-liners of Dante criticism and scholarship of the 20th century, the great fiction of the poem is that it's not a fiction. That is to say that Dante wants us to take it with the same kind of seriousness as we would take biblical events that really did happen. In other words, to suspend our disbelief and to see Dante the pilgrim on this journey, okay, to the afterlife, and to see that this journey is modeled on that movement from creation to judgment that's in Scripture, or some of the other important journey motifs in Scripture, perhaps most important, that of the Exodus.
If we now turn to some specific parts of the Old Testament, especially, because they're perhaps less obviously applicable to a Dante who is a Christian than the New Testament text, the best place to start is the Exodus. This story that really takes up four books of the Old Testament and is referred to constantly and retold in the Psalms and other places. It's, of course, in a literal sense, the journey of the Hebrews from Egypt to Palestine. They get out by going through the Red Sea. They get into Palestine by going through the Jordan. But as soon as we say that, we've only begun the story of the Exodus, as we know today as Americans. We know, for example, how black slaves in the South used the story of the Exodus and not only saw it as an allegory, but also sometimes as almost literally a guide to the Ohio River. So that we find, too, in Dante, it's not just a story, although it is that. It is also the journey from exile to homeland, from bondage to freedom, from death to life. It is the paradigmatic story of the Hebrews, and Dante fully understands and uses it.
So, just to sort of piggyback on that, or to apply Exodus to the poem, it makes sense. It really is a good way to look at the poem to see the Inferno as equivalent to the bondage of Egypt, the Purgatorio as the wandering in the desert, the Paradiso as reaching the promised land. It's also equally important to say, well, really what it's about is this physical, actual geography, but it's also about this internal turn from slavery to freedom. And so, as far as Dante the Pilgrim himself is concerned, the Exodus provides the model from slavery to freedom. Okay? Dante writes a poem about a guy named Dante who starts out dumb and who ends up smart. But it's not dumb and smart in simply intellectual or a cognitive sense. It's spiritually dumb ending up spiritually smart, or spiritually enslaved and ends up spiritually free. So that the whole Exodus motif deals with the poem that he set up, but also, and perhaps even more important, the nature of the journey that he's taking. Dante is, in his own life, in the poem, reenacting the Exodus.
We also want to turn to another hunk of the Old Testament for its particular importance to Dante, and that is the 22 books that are labeled the prophetic books, in particular the 16 books that we call the writing prophets. Now, today, sometimes we have a debased notion of what prophecy means, reading tea leaves or whatever. But my one-liner about Old Testament prophets would be this. Although they are dramatically and intensely concerned with the future, they are deeply, deeply rooted in their past. In other words, if you will, God has a track record. They are very, very careful observers of the present. And only when they've done those things do they really talk in ways that are powerful about the future. It's not guessing. It's not tea leaves. It is prophet who is A, rooted in past, careful observer of present, and therefore can talk intelligently and powerfully about the future.
Now notice that in many examples of prophecy in Hebrew Scripture in the Old Testament, one of the things that enables them to do it, okay, is that they're given some kind of God's eye view of things, and they're able to immerse themselves in the present through the past, and therefore it's almost as though the future is part of this whole continuum. Well, if you begin thinking about that in terms of Dante, it's sort of interesting to see how Dante himself, of course, has this God's eye view of things, because he is taking a journey to realms of experience that are not usually allotted to us on this in this life. Okay? He goes to the three parts of the afterlife. Well, that gives him a perspective that others don't have. It enables him to see what others don't see. But, of course, he takes that perspective and applies it exactly in the manner of the Old Testament prophets to the events of the present time. And so I think the case that we want to make as strongly as possible is that Dante acts as a kind of prophetic commentator on the events of his own time, even as he's very interested in other events and other times, that he wants us, in other words, to see him incorporating the spirit of biblical prophecy into the Commedia itself.
And I think we can sort of end this section by saying just a couple other things. First of all, you know, today one of the phrases we use for prophets is they speak truth to power. that Dante has to learn if he's going to himself speak prophetically, that you have to tell the truth no matter who it might hurt. You've got to tell the truth no matter how much damage the people you tell the truth about can do to you. And that's a very tough lesson. And Dante not only needs to learn that in the abstract, he learns it from the prophets in the concrete. Just follow the story of Jeremiah. He's booted around, he's arrested, he's thrown in a hole because he doesn't have a lot of good news, and kings don't like not good news. And so Dante can not only model prophecy as a form of speaking, he can also model the prophet's life in his own exile and the experience of exile.
So essentially, it's the exile that demands that he begin thinking about things as a prophet would. And that means that his job is to speak to power and to speak to the abuses of power. Well, where does he do that? In the poem itself. One very important way of taking a look at the Divine Comedy is that it is meant to speak to power and to talk about the abuses of power. And like Jeremiah and the other Old Testament prophets, Dante is somebody who comes to this through the experience of exile. That exile, too, was the condition which Jeremiah and the other prophets had to face. And so Dante is saying, well, this condition can be a way of speaking truth to power without regard to the consequences. One way to take a look at that, Dante is able to write the poem from the point of view of somebody who doesn't have a whole heck of a lot more to lose. Okay, he can afford to speak the truth. So that prophetic strain is something that we would say is deep and consistent throughout the entire Commedia.
And while we will argue that if you have to say, pick out one text from the past and put them all in order, which one did Dante use the most or value the most? I think we'd both agree it's the Bible, but it's not the only text. Because Dante, like the Middle Ages in general, is the heir also of the classical tradition, the Greek and Roman tradition, with its myths, with its philosophy, with its literature, with its history. And therefore, we want to turn now at the end of this lecture and continue into the next lecture, saying a little bit about one classical figure of paramount importance, one that strikes us right in Canto 1, because the first person we really meet, other than Dante the Pilgrim himself, is in fact not a Christian, not a biblical figure, but a figure from classical antiquity, a poet named Virgil.
Virgil shows up very early in the poem. He stays for quite a long time. So it turns out that Virgil is Dante's guide for fully two-thirds of the poem. He gives way to Beatrice. You remember we mentioned her in the first lecture as the sort of subject for Dante's early love poetry. Virgil gives way only at the very end of the Purgatorio. So for two-thirds of the poem, he is the one who guides Dante through the afterlife. And it turns out that, not surprisingly, his great epic poem, the Aeneid, was a model for Dante in constructing his own poem, a source for a great many of what is in, for a great many of the episodes that are in Dante's poem, as well as a great many of the characters who are in the poem, and also occasionally a kind of rival to Dante, in the sense that there are things in Virgil that Dante thinks about and that Dante sort of works on, and that Dante redoes and rewrites. And he's sort of not satisfied with the answers that Virgil comes up with in his own poem. So one of the things that I think we would like to come away with in this lecture is the sense that even though the influence of the Bible is clearly paramount to Dante, that Virgil represents something that balances it in a way, that Virgil and the way in which the Aeneid is used in the poem has the same kind of generating and generative force in the poem that that the Bible does.
Perhaps it's worthwhile to just remind ourselves of a little bit of history. Virgil was born in 70 BC in what we would call the late Roman Republic, and he died in 19 BC during the reign of the Emperor Augustus. And this great poem, the Aeneid, he wrote things other than the Aeneid, is in fact the story of the founding of Rome, beginning with the fall of Troy and ending with Aeneas coming to Italy and sort of winning the battles that needed to be won to establish Trojan blood in Italy once and for all. The story itself is important. The episodes and the characters of it are perhaps even more important for what Dante is going to be doing in the Commedia.
And so that's where we will pick it up with the next lecture.